This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Anthony Hamilton's first singing gig was in the church choir when he was just a kid. Who knew he would become a platinum Grammy Award-winning R&B sensation? He was working as a barber in Charlotte when he got discovered, went to New York, was quickly signed to the same label as Sean P. Diddy and Sean P. Diddy Combs and Mary J. Blige. That's the label he gets signed to as a barber from Charlotte. But it would take a full decade before Anthony Hamilton would get his time to shine. After a few false starts, he released the 2003 album Coming From Where I'm From, which featured the hit single Charlene. Baby, it's been 15 years and a lot of great records since the release of that hit song. And a Grammy Award-winning R&B singer, Anthony Hamilton, joins us in the studio today. Welcome, Anthony. Great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Right down the road in Charlotte. By the way, you can watch a live stream of today's show at our Facebook page. So you're a barber in Charlotte, right? Tell me how you could the story about really getting discovered.
Well, you know, child with a dream in Charlotte, North Carolina. Not a lot of outlets for music, you know, so school, school choir, church choir. And then as I got older, talent shows led me to a guy named Mark Sparks, who said, I'm going to take you to New York, be ready at such and such time. He never came. A month later, they were calling me in the barbershop, and my now manager, Eli Davis, was the guy calling back then. And eventually, we linked up. We drove up to New York in a Suzuki Sidekick with seven guys.
That's a trip.
Yeah. And, you know, a series of events, showcases. Russell Simmons came, Andre Harrell, Puff, and there was a lot of heavy hitters in the room at D&D Recording Studios. And Andre Harrell outbidded everybody, him and Jimmy Jenkins, and signed me to Uptown.
So it was actually a bidding war. It wasn't like, is this guy good enough? It was like, oh no, who's going to get him?
After a while, it was just, it was a right down.
But you said that you always had this dream. You always knew you were going to be a star, a singing star.
Yes, I always knew it. I felt it in my bones, in my gut. It would never go away, never let up. And there was nothing else big enough for me to put it second. That was it.
And you were singing, as you said, mostly in the church choir.
Yeah, but I wasn't really tearing the church down. I was kind of just looking around at everybody. And sometimes, you know, some of the older men would sing with so much power, it would scare me. I was like, wow, that's kind of spooky.
Well, what was it? What do you think it was? Because obviously you have that power now. You've got the talent. What was the difference between then? Is it just experience, just a number of years?
I think the experience, the spirit behind life and the situations you've been in, it adds power and grit to your, you know. Those guys were screaming to God for some help, like, hey, God, or thanking God. And it came from a different place that you only get from living.
You were living in New York for a while. Talk about that deal you had with Uptown Records, right? Because that Mary J. Blige is on that record label at the time. Sean Puffy Combs, Jodeci, Heavy D, they're all on that same label, which is not really your music in a sense.
No, it was. It was they were doing more of, it was kind of the end of New Jack Swing with Teddy Roddy and those guys. So, you know, coming into that label, I was opening act for Jodeci. I went on the road. You know, people had never heard of me, and I'd go out there and I'd do my thing, and I got, you know, applause every night. But there was one particular night in Dallas at the Laguna, one of those. It was one of those back in the day. It was a nightclub, and Jodeci, the crowd was extremely, extremely excited to see him, and they wanted to go on before me. And it's like, Jodeci wanted to go on first tonight. I was like, cool.
They're going to open for you.
Shucks.
Oh, no.
But I went out there afterwards, and I did a song called Fallen, that's on my Ecstasy album that never really came out. And I got a standing ovation. The people went crazy. And they came to me and was like, that was real professional what you did out there going on after us like that.
That had to be murder.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it.
It's either you swim or you sink. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? This is an opportunity that I've always wanted, and I'm about to give it to them the best I can.
You did, and your career now speaks for itself, but there were about 10 years there. In fact, we talked about signing with Uptown Records. Mm-hmm. You made an album, but it was never released, right?
Never. No, never.
What do you think happened? What was going on in those early years?
I think the infrastructure and the relationships within the company, they had some inner turmoil to fix MCA and Uptown. They were starting to sever, you know, their relationships. And then once Puffy decided to go do his thing, and Heavy D and a lot of everybody just kind of scattered. So I went to MCA directly. And Hank Shockley was over my project then. And then Heavy D came in. But it wasn't their baby, so they didn't really have the, you know, they had love for me, but it was just like, we're trying to get our names on something and be producers, so.
And you're also writing songs at this time, right? You're writing music.
Yeah, I'm starting to write. Yeah, I'm starting to write.
You wrote a huge hit for Donnell Jones called You Know What's Up. I want to listen to a little clip from that one.
Yeah.
There he is singing live.
Yeah,
with
I co-wrote
Donnell
that
Jones.
With some amazing guys, Cliff and those guys.
And that one went, I mean, that was a big hit.
I needed that at the time. It was one of those times where, you know, you're feeling a little hopeless. Still got love for it, but I needed it. And Eddie F. and those guys invited me over.
I mean, talk about that, because that's got to be, you talk about the ebb and flow. Okay, you're in Charlotte, you're singing for the choir. You're noticing in those choir years, I don't have the power of some of these men standing next to me.
Yeah.
Then you get the call. Let's go to New York. I got the contract. They're bidding for me. And then... nothing. There's no album, and there's this whole fallow period. What's going through your mind then?
The first time that it happened, it was like, okay, all right, that's cool. I'm here. Yeah. They know my name. I've been in the building, and it's cool. Then the second time it happened, it wasn't so cool, but I was like, all right, cool. I have some guys who are trying to bid and buy me out of my contract and all this stuff. And then the third time it happened, it was like, you know what? Come on. Something. This is starting to wear on my spirit now. So it got a little hard.
And also you thought, you realized when you got up there that there's a business side of this too. And that was something that you're very good. You're a great singer and a great songwriter. But now the business end.
And that took the love out of me for a minute. For a minute, I just didn't have it. It took it out, the business side of it. Because it's a creepy business if you don't know it. So I had to learn it.
Well, you did, and I think it was that tour with D'Angelo that helped you a lot. Am I right about that?
Well, that helped me in you know, just get away from the business side of it and have a, you know, to free my mind and to learn about really touring and that aspect of the business and knowing what a great musician and a band should sound like. So I did learn a lot from
What did you learn? What did you learn on that tour?
Wow. What showmanship is, how to captivate a crowd, what a passport is.
Okay.
I've never been anywhere,
you don't really.
You
need that in Charlotte, yeah.
What a passport really is, and, you know, frequent flyer miles and all that kind of stuff. Per diem, all kind of stuff. Like, that's your money to eat per day.
Well, what does that mean, though? Because, again, as a talented singer and someone who'd performed, again, a little bit in the choir, not quite the same thing, but stage presence is a whole different, that's a whole different ballgame.
You have to have it. If a person, if you're performing and you say, you know, for whatever reason, some people may not know you. The people that do, your core fans, they come a little later because they know, hey, he's going to be there and I know what time he's going on. But the people coming in looking for... it's like, we don't know him. It's just the talking, and you have to hit a few notes to hush him up. I got a hush up now. I got a little bit of hush it up in the voice now. So, you know, you learn that.
You got another big break with a song that you did with Jadakiss. Let's listen to a little clip from Why.
Yo, why do people push pounds and powder? Why did Bush knock down the towers? Why you around them cowards? Why Aaliyah have to take that flight? Why my homie D ain't pull out his Ferrari? Why he take that bike? Why they gotta open your package and read your mail? Why they stop letting brothers get degrees in jail? Why you gotta do 85% of your time? And why do rappers lie in 85% of their rhymes? Why brother always...
This is a very short clip from Why, Jadakiss, written by Anthony Hamilton, also singing background on that one. That was a big hit, and that's a political song.
Yeah, it was. And it was a movement back then, and you know, being a part of that was historical, and, you know, historic, and it'll forever be. And, it, you know, it can play right now.
Yeah.
And have a solid foundation to, you know, to back it up.
Well, I want to talk more about that, the politics and the love songs. All of it is part of the career of Anthony Hamilton, a Platinum Grammy Award-winning R&B artist. We'll continue our conversation about his life and career today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us.
Why they stop letting brothers get degrees in jail? Why you got to do 85% of your time? And why do rappers lie in 85% of their rhymes? Why a brother always want what he can't have? Why I can't come through when the pecan jack? Why they crack have to hit so hard even though it's almost over? Why people can't get no jobs? Why they come up with the witness protection? Why they let the Terminator win the election? Come on, pay attention. Why sell in the stores what you can sell in the streets? Why I say the hottest but be selling the least? Why?
This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Charlotte native Anthony Hamilton has 17 Grammy nominations. He's got a win. And before he was successful, solo career got launched. He toured with D'Angelo, made hits with Nappy Roots, Donnell Jones, and won a Grammy with the legendary Al Green. Yeah, there you've got the love I need with, well, that earned my guest, Anthony Hamilton, his first career Grammy. You can watch us on Facebook right now or live streaming today's conversation. Talk about winning a Grammy with Al Green. Pretty great.
That was pretty big. It was not even just for me, for my family and my mother and father and aunts and uncles who all grew up, you know, listening to Al Green.
Yeah.
They probably never dreamed of little old Anthony. Little Peanut.
Is that your nickname?
Singing for a couple of years, right. when I was five or six, but it died pretty fast.
Okay,
but yeah, they never dreamed of that, and me either. Not Al Green, not with him, but you know, Questlove and James Poison and those guys were producing this album, and they thought it would be a great pairing to put me in with Al, and they wanted to bring some more structure, because you know Al goes from the top. He's pretty much freestyles a lot of that stuff, and it's incredible. And I have actually the same talent to be able to hear music and just come off the cuff with something.
You were doing that a minute ago.
Yeah,
pretty wild. So, but what does that mean? Bring more structure? What I mean, because if you're Al Green, who wants to be the guy who's going to rein him in? I wouldn't want that job.
Well, the way to do that, the way it, you know, you come in, he wants to make sure he's comfortable. I didn't ask for any pictures, no autographs. I never ever did. I wish I had, but
when it was over.
Yeah, when it was over. But I wanted him to feel like a musician. And I wanted to give him that respect. But I came in, and where there weren't real chorus and melody, I put melody in the song, especially Lay It Down. Lay It Down, he had, I just met you just the other day. Oh. And he never really had a chorus. And so I came in and said, lay it down, let it go, fall in love. And I just put some harmonies to it, and he loved it.
And is that something you're doing in the studio?
Yeah, we were in the studio at the same time.
Yeah.
When we did the duet, Al was on one mic and I was on one mic at the same time singing. I'm saying, this is old school. This is, you know.
And you got the voice coming in from the booth saying, okay, can we try that one more time? That's pretty good.
You know, we were on a roll, though. So, we, you know, pretty much knocked it out.
So he's got to respect you. You're going to try these things. He is the great Al Green. You are coming up now. You've got a reputation, and you're just hoping he's going to love it.
I wanted him to feel like, okay, he got it. Whatever I was trying to deliver and offer, that he got it, and he appreciated it, and he respected it. What I was bringing, and that felt good that he did.
It probably goes a long way to answer my next question, which is how you stayed grounded, because the music is changing an awful lot in this period, mm-hmm. especially in the 90s. You know, hip-hop is going in many directions.
Yeah.
But it's in many ways moving away from the kind of roots R&B that's marked your career. That has been the hallmark of your career. And how did you stay grounded? Did you feel like you had to anchor yourself to that kind of music? Or,
you know what? Being sought after to sing a lot of rap hooks kept me afloat. You know what I mean? With the one with Jada Kiss, that set me up. The Nappy Roots, that set me up. The Tupac song really solidified me as like, okay, this is the real hip-hop. This is the hip-hop hook goat. Right. So I did, and then after that it was Nelly, and then it was, you know, I did Busta Rhymes, and now Rick Ross. I worked with Nipsey Hussle. I was flown down to co-write with Drake. And, you know, maybe that stuff will be used at some point. But you know, Young Thug, so many rappers that those things kept me afloat, and I was able to still do my R&B for those who loved R&B. But it kept me. It's a perception of me doing something new, mm-hmm. because they saw me here doing R&B, and they saw me doing the rap, and then they see me doing blues. And so I had all these different genres pulling at me and lifting me up, so it was no time for them to second guess me. Thank God.
Well, could you have, I mean, it sounds like you could have just made a living in that hip-hop universe, and you could have abandoned the whole R&B side of it, but you didn't.
I probably would have did okay, but not like now, because I still sell a lot of tickets when it comes to touring.
But that meant you had to know that you and that R&B sound, which again was sort of moving over to the side a little bit.
Yeah.
You had to know that could be mainstream and you could make it.
Yes. My fans let me know that every time they showed up, you know, they showed up for me.
Well, I'm going to talk about your earlier days in Charlotte. Maybe we should just start that whole part of the conversation off with a clip from one of the songs that helped solidify you as an R&B staple. This is a song coming from Where I'm From.
Sitting here, guess I didn't make bail. Got time and a story to tell. Started when I was 9 years old. Woke up and daddy was gone. I started hustling and they couldn't tell me nothing. Running in the hood, trying to be somebody. My soul was on empty. I was searching for something. Tried to be good. Tried to keep from trouble. Living too fast. Trying to make good on a hustle. Sometimes it get rough. Coming from where I'm from. Times got hard.
That is the title track from Anthony Hamilton's album, Coming From Where I'm From. It celebrates its 15th anniversary this year. The Grammy Award-winning R&B artist is my guest today, and you can watch a live stream of today's conversation at our Facebook page. So let's talk about where you're from, Charlotte, and those early years of yours.
Yeah, Charlotte, North Carolina. It's a beautiful place, man. The grass is always green. The sun's always shining. The sky's blue. And even when it rains.
But was that the way it was for you growing up?
Yeah, it was. I had a beautiful, beautiful upbringing. Yeah. There was some, you know, some ups and downs with family and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ended up getting adopted.
Well, talk about that, because you were, what, about 15?
About 15, yeah. My mom had a bout with just not having the right man, so it pushed her closer to, you know, drinking and just wasn't able to be as good as she wanted to be. But she turned it around, and before losing her to cancer, we were close and good. And my dad now, he's pretty, we talk pretty often.
Yeah.
I don't hold grudges. Yeah.
Well, I want to get to that part of the story because a little later on we'll talk about when you actually got back together with your dad and spent a little more time with him. But I want to talk, now you're 15, you're becoming adopted. What was that like? Who's the family?
Oh, well, beautiful family, man. I was playing football and, being on the football team, you get to know people and then people get to know your story. My friend Steve and Reese, his name is Reese, Reese Way. And they came over one day and I was like, man, I said, yeah, things ain't all that great. So I used to go over and I would come in the house, I would say, mother, to his mom, and they fell in love. His dad was like, yeah, I like you, but I don't know, I'm watching you. So eventually, we had to go through the adoption thing. He was like, he needs someone to stay somewhere, because he'd gone through. And they took me in, and that was a stability that I needed.
Were you doing that little Eddie Haskell thing? Hello, Mrs. Cleaver.
With a little more pizzazz. I put a little more clamor on my Cleaver.
Yeah. But were you singing at the church? By this time, at 15, you're playing football, but you're also singing?
I was just forming little groups around with some of the guys from school.
Yeah.
And,
when did you start cutting hair?
Wow. My first haircut was, I was 13, and I did it with a pair of scissors and a big shaver. And it's a guy named Sean, and he had the thickest, most curly, coiled, thick African hair you ever wanted to see in your life. But it was, I was like, I can do something with it. He didn't have a shape up. He was just letting it grow. I was like, I cut it with the scissors and I shaped it up with the bic and I gave him like a little line. And I was like, man, I did it. I don't know what made me think I could do that, but I did. He liked it.
He liked it.
And from then on, I was just like, yeah.
And for a while, you were just cutting it in your backyard, right?
Yeah, I just cut it in the backyard and in the den was, because we wanted to keep away from what we call skeeters, the mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. So I cut in the right where the kitchen and the den meet. That was my barbershop. And then eventually I went to a shop over on West Boulevard.
I saw an interview that you did recently, or relatively recently on NPR, and you went back to that shop, right?
Yeah, I did. Actually, Mary Reeves, she's one of the best barbers ever. This woman could cut and still can do it. Fade, incredible, incredible fade. Actually, her shop was pretty full, so there was a shop next to hers where I cut. But, yeah.
Were you doing, because in that, obviously this was a little bit staged, you had a lot of your friends there, you're going back, taking a look, and everybody's talking, so we'll talk about the environment there and what people are having conversations in that barbershop, but also singing. Was there much of that going on, or was that mostly for the NPR?
Even in barber school, man, I used to sing every song came on the radio, and everybody was like, hey, turn it up so Ham can sing. And in the barbershop, it stayed with me. I would always sing. And when we went back this last time, the group, the Hamiltones, who are my background singers, they went along with me.
Oh, those are the guys singing with you?
Yeah.
Well, is that, I wonder, how did you get discovered when you talked about Mark coming up and saying he's going to take you to New York? Where did he hear you?
Well, just people talking about me.
Yeah.
That time, back then, I had met Horace Brown. He was on Uptown MCA as well. And so my name started getting around. They knew this guy. Mark had done work with Mary J. Blige and Grand Poobah and some of the rappers back in the day. And he heard of me through a guy named Dizzy, who was a rapper, local rapper and producer. And he set it up. It's like, hey, I got this guy I want you to meet. I was like, cool, I'll come and meet him. So he played this music. He was working on his music, these hip-hop tracks. It was like before Kanye was Kanye. And and DJ Premier and all these cats. Like, it was, there was Mark Sparks, and he was incredible and still has it. And he pretty much helped me shape my sound, because I didn't really, I knew I could sing. And, you know, he helped me shape my sound. But my first song was written, my brother, Keith, he had a CNC. It was a label in Charlotte. And I was like, wow, okay, we're going to do it. We had, you know, some successes. And I was just like, you know what, I got to go. I got to go bring it back. And that's the first time I ever wrote a song back. And it was I'm Waiting for You. And I didn't know I could write.
Wow.
But so I had that, and I was trying to get signed, and I was trying to get my cassette tape to Jodeci. And when Jodeci and Left Eye's group, TLC, they were on tour, and I would be out there, hey. And they were on tour with MC Hammer. So I had this cassette. I was having all the time, like, somebody's going to hear me.
Yeah.
But eventually Mark worked it out.
All these names, man. MC Hammer. What was the music scene like in Charlotte then?
There wasn't a real music scene at the time. There was just a bunch of guys who you know, thought about it. Jodeci gave us, you know, a lot of hope. And
you talked about the label helping to shape, or producers shaping your sound. What does that mean? Because obviously you had talent.
Yeah.
What did you learn? What changed as you became more professional?
I learned that my voice is only my voice, and it's only powerful and special when I do what is for me. Mm-hmm. Singing like I sing, not trying to sing like I'm not a Brian McKnight, even though I have a falsetto. I'm not, you know, some of the other guys. I'm not all the way Bobby Womack. I'm not all the way Boyz II Men or any of the other guys. I'm Anthony. And when I stick to that, there's special things that happens in the voice, and it resonates to people.
When people hear that, it sounds kind of obvious, right? Stay true to yourself, sing from the heart, sing from the soul. I mean, it almost seems obvious, but here's what's not obvious. You're trying to make it in a business, and you look all around you, and you see the people who have, and you've named a couple like Bobby Womack and some others who have made it. It must be really hard not to just try to imitate the ones who've already made it, and to go back to that sound that you, some part of you is saying, it's your only hope, but the other part is saying, yeah, but he already made it. Let's be like him.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I did actually was take a little bit of all that and embellished who I was. It, like the Bill Withers is one of my favorites, a great songwriter, the way he would sing. Not a lot of tricks to the voice, but just straight up singing and great songwriting. And the Bobby Womacks and the Al Greens, the Aretha Franklin, Joe Cocker. So all these people who had all this stuff in their voice, I would imitate them. And I would, that's how I would train my voice to get better. And when it went in, it didn't come out quite like theirs, but it came out like me.
But that's how you find your own.
Yeah, that's how you find it.
Right, because these other, I mean, they're all, in a sense, creating a kind of a definition. There are borders and boundaries. Can't go there, can't go there. What's
exactly.
left, oh, that must be me. Right?
Yeah.
Well, and also talk about the gospel tradition, too, because we talked about that choir, and you hearing those powerful voices and those men calling out to God, and you could hear something.
Yeah.
There's been a tension in the gospel community about people going commercial, singing love songs. Did you feel any of that?
You know what? There's a few people here and there. You ought to be singing gospel. I said, well, I'm going to sing it when God tells me to. I'm pretty sure I got a great line that's pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And he talks to me when he needs. And I know where I'm supposed to be. And I put love in my song. So I think I'm doing all right. But there's always that. And then you feel like, well, maybe I am. Is this sin music? Maybe that's why it's not working. Mm-hmm. And no. And I have had a lot of pastors to come to my show. T.D. Jakes has been to one of my shows. Lots of pastors come. Mm.
Is there? Do you take anything from that tradition? I mean, did that training?
Of course.
Yeah.
I
mean, you can hear it in the music. I think.
I don't feel no waste time. Come too far from where I started from. Nobody told me that the road would be easy. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me. And you take that and what that feels like and what it means, what it stands for, you know, in life. That sound is not just music. It's a victory. There's a triumph and there's hardship and there's everything. And you take that and you let it be a part of your soul.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. And I think that, you know, you put your finger on it, the idea that in some ways, and I'll put it a different way, it's this marriage of heaven and hell, right? This is the ability to talk about the good and the bad and feel it.
Mm-hmm.
That is certainly what the gospel should be all about, right?
Yeah.
It's bringing those things together and living your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's any authenticity and any line that runs through those commercial music and gospel, it's probably that.
Yeah, and the truth. Most of it, you know, the true gospel and the true spirit behind all that stuff is when it's honest and it's the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we are speaking the truth right now, and I'm speaking it with Anthony Hamilton, a Grammy Award-winning R&B singer and songwriter. And our conversation will continue on the state of things right after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Grammy Award-winning R&B singer and songwriter Anthony Hamilton. He's a Charlotte native, a father, and a man who knows a love song, a song like Can't Let Go.
No matter what the people say, I can't let go. I can't let go. No. Oh.
Just a little bit of Can't Let Go, a song written and sung by my guest, Anthony Hamilton. Talk about love songs, because a second ago we talked about, you know, songs need to come from the heart. They need to be authentic. But, mm-hmm. I mean, the joke is I don't want to be a singer-songwriter because I can't afford to, you know, break up that much.
Yeah, I've had my share of some breakups and some great relationships.
How do you approach a love song like that, especially, you know, as your career advances?
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's been a relationship and it's ended, there's things that you could take from it to sing about and reflect on, like, you know, what it was that you know, that pulled you guys apart. Mm-hmm. You speak about that and you speak about it honestly. Was it me? Was it me out? Was it me drinking? Was it me staying out late? Was it the women? Just my obsession with music, mm-hmm. and never allowing that person to be as special as my music. I think that's been a big problem with me.
And you've talked about that. You're because I know fans were really, and I'm sure you were too, sorry to hear about the breakup of your marriage.
Yeah.
Many years. I mean, tell us about that and what part that played in your music and your life.
Well, great marriage. We gave it all. We have three amazing kids. A 6-year-old now, and the twins will be 8. And they're beautiful, and we co-parent extremely well, and we still love each other. I just actually did a showcase with her in Cleveland, and a song that she's putting out called "I'm Ready," Tarshae Hamilton, and it's available on iTunes. But we, you know, you go through that, and you get to know yourself in pain and love and in victory and then failing and all that, and you get up and you say, you know what? What can I learn from this? What can I put out there and share with the people?
What did you learn? What did you learn from that?
I learned that you have to fight fair and you have to be honest with yourself if you are doing it for a reason other than love, and if you're not truly committed or you're not able to give this person what you feel like they deserve, then you have to set them free to get to what it is they need and what they deserve, if you truly love them.
There it is. You have just redeemed the commercial love song. There's heart and soul in it. And again, this marriage of heaven and hell, like there was a lot of good and a lot of really happiness.
It was a lot of good,
you know, it may not have been a marriage.
Yeah. But we sang together and we toured the world and with Africa. We saw Europe and we did some amazing things. And I'm grateful for her and she's grateful for me.
What about co-parenting? Talk about that now. And being on tour, trying to be a dad, trying to, you know, make sure that you maintain that relationship with your kids. But it's a busy schedule still for you.
Yeah. Well, I have actually 6 boys. I have 3 older, 21, 27, and Anthony will be actually 30 in a couple days. You have to know that they're a priority no matter how old they get. they still need that. They still need dad, and they still need that time to feel loved and for me to show them how to be a man. So what I do, if the boy's out of school, I take him on tour and let him see what I'm doing. So when I'm not there, they say, Daddy's working. He's out there singing for the people. And then the mom gets a chance to get a break. And, it keeps the tension down. With my older boys, I invite them out or, see what they're doing. And most of them are into music. So you find a way to make it happen.
We have an advanced copy of a new track from your forthcoming album. It is called Love Conquers All, and I'd like to hear
what?
A little clip from that. I don't know how we
Frankie,
got it.
Frankie, baby. That's Frankie, baby. Do y'all not know that?
Frankie, baby.
Police want to kill us for no reason. It's harder here to make it, causing no jobs. And we're losing hope. Nothing ever changes, but we still march. So much blood on the streets, hard to wash it off. The perils of winning on our own soil. Lord, where do we go?
So tired of running.
And tired of running, so sick and tired of crying.
A little bit of Love Conquers All from Anthony Hamilton's forthcoming album. My guest today, we've been sharing this delightful conversation, lots of humor and lots of deep insights. But there's a powerful song, and that's about something now, and it's got a political message as well.
Yeah. When the cops and the injustice against my people, your people, poor people, and when that started happening, it hit something, and then it struck something up in me, and it pissed me off, and I wanted to write about it, and I wanted to let people know that, these cops are killing. Now it's senseless killings, and people are starting to call the cops now for no reason. Like, a young lady called on a little boy's backpack, brushed her, and she quickly called the cops. It was like, now people are wanting to see us die because they know that there's angry cops and there's no love amongst the people. And this song is to encourage people, like, here it is. This is blatant, and you guys need to really pay attention, and that's got to be a solution. Mm-hmm. And, I think if we learn to love ourselves, then we can start loving somebody else because...
I mean, it can be a difficult message, too, because you talked about this coming initially, at least being motivated out of anger. And
yeah.
And yet the title of the song is Love Conquers All. And I'm assuming that this would go for law enforcement and for people who are being victimized by this. That
yes.
If your message is there's only one way through this and like it or not.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Where do you find that? How do you start from a place of anger and then write a song called Love Conquers All?
Well, you love so hard for the people who are being victimized that the anger, the love for them starts to scream out at the people who have power to change it.
What about the people in your position, right? You are a commercially successful music singer-songwriter. Do you have a role to play in politics? Do you think that you should be talking about these questions?
Yeah, I think I should. I think I should voice my opinion. I think I can speak for those who are afraid to speak or who may not have the platform, or I can be a segue to get their messages through my social sites, which is Anthony Hamilton Official on Instagram. And you guys, if you're not following me, you should follow me because I'm kind of exciting.
You haven't already figured it out.
Yeah, you know. But I have to. You have to. To whom much is given, much is required, and I have to stand for something.
Mm-hmm. And you're on multiple platforms. Do you have a preference? Which platform do you prefer? How do you position yourself on each of those different platforms? Let's put it that way.
Well, Twitter. When I was on Twitter really heavy, I would voice my opinion, my political opinion, and my opinion about just things happening in all over the world. And for Instagram, it's a place that I do some of the same thing, but I put pictures of the family and kids, and it's kind of a lighter side, a funnier side, and a humor to it. But there's still those moments when if something's happening that needs to be heard, then we'll put it out there. And Facebook is just, you know, let me find old Uncle June. Is Uncle June? Is Uncle June? Is it, y'all seen Uncle June out there? He was out there cutting grass. He needs some milk.
That's why I'm not on Facebook. You nailed it. You know, but I think about even that, going back to that song "Love Conquers All," and thinking about these platforms, because if we have become so divided, and if people are so confident that they can get the kind of revenge that, you know, through our criminal justice system, like call the cops because they'll get away with it.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. They'll get away with it. So just call police because they can do whatever.
Yeah.
But how much of that is, do you think, the result of how fractured and siloed we've become, not in total because of social media, but the fact that we just don't really even know each other anymore personally?
We don't. Some people don't even have an interest. They just rather, you know, learn through the hate from the people before them who taught them. My boys go to school, and there was just one incident where this little boy says, well, white people are better than blacks, and the Latino people are at the bottom. And I told him, kids are not born with that type of mentality. Right. He's either heard somebody say it, or he's been taught, or somewhere on social media. But if we start with the kids and teaching them about love and accepting people and seeing the beauty in people, then we can change that. And you have to teach your kids. I teach my kids that, you know, we come from a powerful people. We've created and built a lot. It's not just what you see. It's not going to be in our textbooks. So I have to go out and teach them who they are and how amazing they are.
Yeah, that's the other story that, you know, we started to tell that story in the 70s with the nationalist movement. And then...
Yeah.
I don't know, things in some ways seem to get side-channeled. Because if you remember back in that era, right, the caution to the civil rights movement was, look, this is going to take time, but it's changing. This is the message in the 50s and 60s. It's changing. It's just going to take time, and people won't think that way next generation. And now you're telling me your kids are hearing it in school in 2018.
Yeah.
So you see, it wouldn't just go away, would it?
No, it doesn't go away if you keep rebirthing it.
If you keep rebirthing it. What about your next album? Tell me more about this album now and how you're approaching the newest album.
You know what? I want to, you know, what's going on now? You know, you want to speak about that, but you want to still have fun and encourage people to dance and love. I don't want it just to be this heavy album you listening to. It's like, poof, you ran off the road because he's too deep. You know what I mean? I don't want it to be this like suicide album.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to touch on some things that make people think and really be honest with themselves. Like, hey, where are we? Where am I? Either in my relationship or in the world or just something, a real body of work. And I want the best, engineers and the best musicians. I want to bring back music like Isaac Hayes and Barry White and, you know, the string, the orchestras and all that. I want a real album.
What struck me in Love Conquers All, that just that clip we played, and through a lot of your music, there's not a heavy reliance on technology. We've got a piano, we've got some backup vocals, maybe some maybe a little processing that I didn't notice, but I mean, it's very
really
stripped
raw.
Down. I mean, if you can't sing and play, then it's not going to be a good record.
No, it won't.
Right?
And I take pride in being able to go out there and do it every night, and people really like, wow. I think it sounds better live than, you know, than the albums most of the time, because you have this adrenaline and the people behind you.
Before I let you go, I want to play this because we've got a clip from your performance on the hit Fox series Empire. Very cool. Let's listen to a little of this.
I'm sorry.
I can't stay away from you too long. Even if I do, I'll always call. Check in on you, make sure you're okay. And be the one to brighten up your day. And the point of it all, it's I love you.
Anthony Hamilton, the point of it all on the Fox series Empire. He's my guest today. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was beautiful, man. You know, John Singleton, he directed that particular episode, and Terrence and I go back a little way. So to be on that set, it was electrifying, and, you know, it was a beautiful moment to be able to sing that.
So what's next? Where are you headed? Where's the career going from here?
You know, I'm going to South Africa again in December, and before that, I'm going to go in and record pretty hard in November, and just keep doing it, rocking it till the wheels fall off, and giving the people all the music that I can get. The Christmas album, Home for the Holidays, is available, and also I'll have three songs on Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton is covering three of your songs, right?
Yeah, he's covering three of my songs, which is awesome. Oh. I talked to him, you know, it's awesome to talk to him.
Can he still play?
Man.
I'm just wondering.
Sing and play.
What a pleasure talking with you, Anthony.
It's been
so
good,
much.
Man. Frankie Baby, everybody. Frankie Baby, everybody.
That's going to be on the next album, right?
That's right, man.
It's a promise. Anthony Hamilton, Grammy Award-winning R&B singer and songwriter, Charlotte native, living in Charlotte now. And you can find out more about the show at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.